Welcome to Sun to the Flag Radio, brought to you by Fire Engineering Blog Talk Radio. Our mission at Sun to the Flag is to revolutionize burn care and the quality of life for veterans, first responders, and families. We bring together passionate community leaders, pioneering physicians, experienced military service members, dedicated first responders, and purposeful civilians to complete our mission. Sons of the Flag, we believe that the future of burn care resides in research and development, and our mission is to accelerate this process of testing leading technologies and pushing them into circulation for immediate use by burn survivors across the nation. As we start every show, Landon and I, yep. This is Justin Bemis, Landon, the man, the myth, the legend. We're going to start tonight's show by honoring our fallen brothers and sisters. It's our last show. And then we'll do a brief pause for our fallen law enforcement, since it is law enforcement week as we record this week, and our military veterans that we've also lost overseas and here at home to PTSD or other issues. So, since our last show, Tony Duvin Vorde, Cody Mullins, Horace Wright, Fred Fettler, Chester Locke, Roy Sewell. May we take a moment of silence for him. All right.
You know, that's such a stark... I mentioned it last time.
Yeah.
I hate that there's any names on that list, but the last two times we've done this, the list has been so short. And coming from the past 2 years, mm-hmm. where we lost so many...
Yeah.
I hope that's a trend.
It's 27 as of right now this year, and we're coming into June, and I'd hate to say that's a great number, but it is. You know, one name that's not on there, we lost a local firefighter here up in McKinney, a good guy. I've gone to classes with him. Captain Jamie Graham was killed at a MVC a couple weeks ago, heading to the college that I teach at, and so I want to also honor him because we do have a lot of McKinney firefighters that do a lot with our organization. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's important that we honor and recognize him and his commitment to the fire service. And it's a huge, unfortunate loss. But you know what? He left us in a really good spot. And so it's a beautiful thing to honor and carry these names forward and yep. make sure we honor them and respect
and
them.
Let and let everybody hear them.
Yeah, know their stories, man, because these guys have got great stories. And just like our guest tonight, this is a notable fire. When Greg Turnell... reached out to us and said, I have a guest for you. And whenever Greg,
whenever
he reaches out, it's usually somebody good.
Yeah, whenever
so,
Greg reaches out, you're like, this is going to be good.
But Greg reached out to us and said, hey, I've got a guest I want you guys to talk to. And I'm like, well, who do you got? And he goes, you know, the Cherry Road fire. I'm like, well, yeah, hopefully most firefighters have at least heard about it or have not read the reports about it. And he's like, well, my buddy, Lieutenant Joe Morgan, would love to join the show. And I remember I texted Landon and I'm like, is he for real? Like, this is, yeah, please, absolutely.
Yeah, there's no question.
Yeah, and so tonight's guest, I'm honored and just absolutely privileged to be able to sit here and talk to this gentleman, you know, just to sit here and listen to this story as we come up on the anniversary of the actual fire, May 30th, 1999.
The day that you're going to be listening to this.
Yeah, the day the show comes out. So when you guys listen to the show, it's going to be May 30th. It'll be the anniversary. But our distinguished guest tonight, Lieutenant Joe Morgan, thanks for being here, brother.
Thank you so much for having me, brother. I really appreciate it.
No, I know it's a tough time to come on and talk about these types of stories. But, man, I'm just telling you, just to know that young guys such as myself and new firefighters, that your story and your brother's stories can continue on is the most important thing, that we never forget, you know, the sacrifices that occurred that day.
Hey man, thank you so much. It's amazing to me when I sit down to talk about it and the story is revisited. Most recently I spoke with a graduating class from a local fire department. And I normally ask the question of, what is my audience? What is the age range of the audience?
Right.
And I'll ask them if anyone is under 20 years old or so, you know, around that age group. Mm-hmm. And it always amazes me how the hands will be raised, and to think that these kids are coming into the department and they weren't even born
Yeah.
at the time when I got hurt. And to be able to share my story with them, just to give them some insight of how serious our job is as firefighters, not only firefighters, military, the police officers, all the first responders, but the seriousness of the job. And anyway, I don't want to get too serious now. I just wanted to say, hey, and that just came to mind right as you mentioned that. So,
That is an incredible gosh, I don't. It's strange whenever you think like you're talking to these guys who weren't born then, and yet the commitment. There's something in the military and the police officer and firefighter genetics where it's like they just gravitate to it,
Yeah.
and for them to be able to hear your story is incredible.
I think you nailed it perfectly. We'll talk about it, but the commitment and the dangers of this job, my fear is that sometimes some departments and some guys are just seeing a paycheck and they're going to do this job just because it's a checkbox for them just to have a job. And there's an underlying seriousness and danger to the job. To me, the Cherry Road Fire is up there on, up to the same level as Black
Black
Sunday,
Sunday, yeah.
right? And so, we know the stories about that. And then the stories that we're going to continue to hear down the road, just like 9/11, right? Half these guys in the fire service now were not alive at 9/11 either. So it's a new concept that we make sure we remember what we've done. And I think it's important
And learning these lessons
that,
is,
hear your
yes.
words straight from your mouth and let them know exactly what occurred. And most importantly, in my view, the lessons learned, right?
Yes,
That's what,
yes.
no sacrifice can go without a lesson learned, and we have to learn from it so it doesn't occur again. And we remember the legacies and we honor them to move forward and make sure that our guys are trained up the way that we need to do in order to do our job. So,
Absolutely.
with that being said,
Absolutely.
let's talk about why did you join the fire service? Was it a family thing? Did you just, get that itch, that calling, or how did you
How did you
get
become one of
so
those young
involved?
20-year-olds
Yeah.
in the fire department?
I'm sitting here laughing to myself because you had mentioned for some of the guys, it's the job is just a paycheck. And to be honest, absolutely transparent, when I first became a firefighter, it was for the paycheck. I was a single parent at the time. I was raising my son. The job that I had, I was making $22,000 a year, and I was wanted to send him to private school, and the private school was, I think, either $2,000 or $2,500 a year, and I was working part time trying to figure it out. And the fire department started off with a salary of $25,000 a year, and
Yeah.
man,
Gum.
it just hit right into the
Yeah, that 25 extra
pot.
100 bucks
Yeah.
goes a long way.
It goes a long way. It goes a long way. So that's how I actually got started.
That's awesome.
And I can honestly say when I was at the training academy, I had no idea what I was getting into. I didn't have any reference. I didn't know any firefighters at the time. I'm a first generation firefighter in my family. And once I got to the academy, there were times when we were doing some of the drills and I was thinking, what have I gotten myself into?
You're right.
And so it really was a eye-opening experience. It was very physical and challenging, and I was pretty athletic, so that was a challenge for me. I enjoyed that part of it. But it wasn't until I actually got into the company when I really started to understand the job itself and when I really fell in love with it. And the fighting the fire was great. It's an adrenaline rush, and it was what we joined the department to do. But it was the interaction that I had with the community
Yes.
that really sparked my love for the job.
That's awesome.
So
Yeah.
yeah, that's how it all began for me.
I'm big on Alan Brunicini. It's customer service, and I think that's where a lot of us in the fire service, and I don't, I should, backtrack real quick. I don't think a lot of us in the fire service, I think a lot of us in the fire service these days understand there's a community service and a customer service side that to be a part of the community is it's our only success, right? I mean, look at all the police departments. You know, we have so many police departments being defunded because I don't think they have that community alignment that we need to have in the fire service. And I think that we've done really well at in the fire service. You know, customer service and community involvement is paramount to our success. I mean, we have to have it.
And as a civilian, that's one of the more interesting things that I find whenever I go to these fire conferences. And I think you might be one of the first guests to mention, you know, the community aspect of it. But at every fire conference, that's something that is routinely, you know, enforced. It's like we're servants of this community. We are here to serve and protect life and property. And that's such a massive driving force behind what y'all do.
Yes.
You know, it's kind of like when you swear that oath, right, you get that badge pinned under your chest, the amount of weight that is now sitting on you, the responsibility that is now upon you. You know, when I teach the recruits at the Fire Academy right now up here at Collin College, the job's not done. You just graduated Fire Academy. Good job. Guess what? The real job starts now.
And it's just beginning.
Yes. And it's a continual learning moment. But the thing that we all fail to teach, and I think, is the community service side. And I think that's what most people, like you said, you get involved in you get to a good house, and all of a sudden, man, community involvement's huge.
Yeah.
You got to have it.
It is.
That's awesome.
It is. Yes.
So when you became a firefighter, I mean, this community aspect, like you go from, okay, I need the money to this is a lifestyle. Talk about that lifestyle. Mm-hmm. Talk about being in D.C. and being around that community.
It was a very interesting dynamic for me because I grew up in Washington, D.C. I was born and raised in the city. And so being a part of that community, being a part of the fire service community, as well as the neighborhood community, was a how do I put it? Trying to meld that together was difficult at times because, you know, and this is not to say to drive any nails into some of the services or some of the guys that were servicing the community, but you could honestly tell those who weren't necessarily from D.C. that were coming in to work in D.C. and then going back home, as opposed to those who grew up in the city.
Right.
And it was a stark difference in the way that we handled the residents of the city.
Yeah.
But with that being said, you know, I had the opportunity, and I can't say that I made a difference everywhere, but I had the opportunity to be that bridge between the guys who were just coming into the city to work and the actual community. That's because great. I was that community. So, you know, it's just coming to my mind now as we're talking about it, that I was actually a bridge between the two. But the fire service is a true brotherhood, something that I had never experienced before. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are stark differences between, you know, race relations and cultural relations. There's a difference there. But when you actually come together and you're doing a job that requires you to leave all that behind and to work as a team, that's the amazing part of that job. And I just loved it so much. And then we got to the place where we sat down and we broke bread together. We had dinner together. We slept together. You become a true family.
Yes.
And no matter what your differences are, you have to set those aside when you're out there doing your job.
Yeah.
And so you kind of grew up. It's almost like having the big brother, little brother scenario where you guys don't get along, but you love each other anyway.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, have that.
Yeah. Yes. So that's what it reminds me of.
I mean, it's almost like it was a divine appointment for you that you were meant to be there for that reason, to maybe bridge that gap between the community and the fire service itself.
And that's such an interesting gap to have to relay, because there is, you know, even if you just go visit another place, it's not your home. Mm-hmm. You don't have that connection to it. You don't, and unfortunately, you don't have a certain respect for it. And for somebody like yourself to be there and say, you know, this is where I grew up, this is where my roots are, and to be able to translate that into service and those guys coming in and explaining that to them, I mean, that changes the entire dynamic of not only just your relationship, but of the fire department itself.
Yes. Yes.
So when you came – oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I'm no, gonna... I was just going to ask – I was going to follow up with another question. No, I was only – if you got something to add to it, please do.
No. I was basically just agreeing with that. It definitely it was an opportunity to share, be a difference maker.
Yeah.
And I didn't even realize it at the time that that's the position that God had me in. I didn't even realize it, but now I do because we're having this conversation. So, yeah.
That's awesome.
Hindsight 2020 thing.
Right.
Yes. Yes.
So when you came out of the academy, where were you assigned? What was your initial assignment?
So my initial assignment was Engine Company 3, which is a small house, a single engine, and we had an ambulance that ran out of the same house. It was located very close to Capitol. Well, it was in Capitol Hill, but it was very close to the Capitol.
Okay.
And in the northwest section of D.C. Oh, and the beautiful thing I loved about that little tiny house is that we ran all four sections of the city from that location. So we were in an ideal spot where we would either run Northwest Washington. You know, for those who don't know, Washington, D.C. is broken out into four separate sections of the city. You have Northwest, Southwest, Southeast, and Northeast. And so our little firehouse would run all four sections of the city. So we had the chance to work with, different firehouses and companies as we're running fire calls and emergencies. But we also had to learn all four sections of the city, which is unique because there, from where we are, there was a D Street Northwest, a D Street Southeast, and a D Street Southwest, and you had to know which one you were going to.
That right. Sounds confusing for me.
It was so it was very it, that was what was so new, unique about that place, and I really, really enjoyed it. So,
you know, it's unique because, you know, once I found out we were interviewing you, that was one of the first things. A lot of times I'll just start researching, you know, the agency, you know, a little bit more to get a better understanding. And DC has a fantastic site, the way that they lay it out with their, where their, you know, their houses are at. And it, you said, and as soon as you said it, I knew exactly what you're talking about. And to know that you're running basically the entire city from that location is unbelievable.
Well, the different demographics that you must have ran into just doing that. I mean, from upper to lower, I mean, you're kind of hitting all the different ranges, and the interactions just had to be extremely unique.
Yes, absolutely. We've had the opportunity to run the Capitol. I used to transfer to one of the other companies, and we would support the White House and the president. I had the opportunity to work at the fireboat, which was in our division. And so the fireboat would run, you know, the entire section of the city that was covered by water. I had a great location. It was a great house, and it afforded me a lot of great opportunities to work in different sections of the city and do different, totally different jobs.
That is awesome.
That is.
I'm completely envious right now.
where Bemis works, there's mostly fields and stuff like that. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I got your grass fires covered if you need them.
And in Texas, those, we need that. Golly.
So what year did you actually, I don't know if I caught or not, what year did you actually go through the academy and become sworn in as a firefighter for D.C.?
So December 1990 was when I started the academy, and that was in the capacity of going through EMT school. That was one of the requirements where, you know, nowadays I think the departments want you to already have EMT as you're coming in.
Right.
Where when I came on board, we actually learned EMT first, And we had to pass that before we can actually go to fire school.
Gotcha.
So that was in December 1990. Then I started fire training in January of 91. And I believe our graduation was somewhere around April or March of 91.
Okay.
And from there, I went to Engine 3. And I was at Engine 3 for about 2 years. And then they closed that firehouse. And I transferred from there to another location. And then I ended up transferring one more time when I ended up at Engine 26, which was my home at the time that I got hurt.
Okay. So that's gonna we probably kind of lead into that real quick. So
What was going through my head is joined in the 90s and yet 99, not that far off. That's such a pivotal year for you. I mean that. So let's jump into the day. Kind of describe, if you remember, kind of how the day opened up, and we'll get into the call.
I do. Well, I was working overtime that night. My actual shift ended Saturday morning. I worked Friday. Saturday morning, I got a tap on the bunk, and while I was, in the bunk room, for those who are not familiar, we're in the bunk room where we sleep, where we lay our heads down for the night, and I got a tap on my bed that morning to ask me if I would be interested in working overtime because it was the holiday weekend. And oftentimes, that's a time when you'll have the most overtime opportunities around holidays because a lot of guys will take off, take vacation, or whatever the case may be. So they asked me if I wanted to work that night, and I told them yes, of course, because my girlfriend and I, who's my wife now, but my girlfriend and I were planning on taking our kids on vacation. So it, for me, it was an opportunity to make a little extra money that would have the pocket change while we're on vacation. And I remember, and she reminded me of a lot of this, but we spent the entire day together. And when I was telling her that, I was supposed to go in that night and work overtime, she was asking me not to go. She said, "Why don't you just tell them you can't come in? We can just continue that. To continue our Saturday and go from there." And little did I know at that time that her request was because she felt something dooming. She couldn't explain it, but she said she had this uneasy feeling, and she just wanted me to forego working that night and stay home. And what is interesting to some is that I was a technician at the time, a wagon driver. And so I was supposed to drive that night. When I went into work, one of the guys who had been driving all day, he was a he had been working at Engine 26 for quite a few years, and I had a lot of respect for him as a firefighter, as a person, and I didn't feel that I wanted to bump him from driving that night when I had the opportunity to maybe catch some fire. So I told him to go ahead and drive, and I would ride the back step, hoping to catch some fire that night.
Yeah.
And boy, did I ever.
Golly.
So, May 30th, 1999,
Yes.
3146 Cherry Road, right, Northeast Washington, D.C. The initial call was a townhouse fire, right? And then
That's correct.
the information wasn't relayed in initially that the fire was in the basement, right? And from reading the
Yes.
reports, most of y'all didn't gather that information. If I'm correct. If I'm wrong, please correct me. But that information wasn't relayed or y'all didn't receive it. Am I right?
Well, so yes and no. And I'll explain why.
Yeah.
So we actually, my company had responded on a call earlier. It was for a motor vehicle accident. And so we were actually heading back to the firehouse at the time of the call. So imagine, if you will, you're going up a street, a road that has a hill, and at the top of the hill, is the firehouse off to the left-hand side. You would be able to see it. So we were coming back to the firehouse, cresting that hill, and we got the call. And they asked us to re respond on the fire and reported townhouse fire. And they gave us the address, told us we were first due, and we headed in that direction. So once we got to that top of the hill, I can actually see our firehouse off to the left-hand side. It was a cross street of Rhode Island Avenue, and we were on Montana Avenue. And so we took a right-hand turn to head towards the fire. And I could see the bay door for the truck company starting to rise. And I didn't mention that engine 26, where I was at this time, it was a double house. So we had a engine and a truck running out of that house. So the bay door for the truck company was starting to rise. We took the right-hand turn. They had their lights on. I knew that they were responding behind us. And so as we were en route, I heard communications come back across the radio to say, engine 26, be advised that it's a report of a basement fire.
Okay.
And so, and we continued to head in that direction. I could feel the wagon driver put a little more pressure on the gas pedal as we were going down Rhode Island Avenue. So I heard the report that was given by communications. I'm not sure, you know, it was so much going on at the time. I can't say that
Right.
that the officer responded to that or not, or if any of the other companies had responded to that, but I know that I heard it. And so,
So as you guys are
yes.
arriving, what is kind of going through your mind? Obviously, y'all are a little bit more amplified, obviously. But what's kind of going through your mind? What are you seeing as you guys are arriving on scene?
Well, the first thing I noticed as we were coming into the block, you could see a haze of smoke in the area. You could smell it in the air, and I turned to my partner in the back, Lou Matthews, at the time, and he was running the line company, and I was running the layout. And I said to him, "This is the real deal, baby. You know, are you ready?" And so he had, you know, the big smile on his face, and he's like, "Yeah, I'm ready." And I noticed that someone from the neighborhood ran out into the street to point towards the house. So, you know, anytime you have somebody that runs out in front of a moving fire truck, you know it's the real deal. You know this is absolutely a working fire. So, again, it's my position as the layout. I wanted to make sure that I got the hose line hooked up to the hydrant. So that we would have water. And one of our rival companies, Engine Company 10, which is
Neighboring, right?
neighboring firehouse, we you know, we had that healthy rivalry
Yes, sir.
and you know, opposing companies. And so they pulled up to pick up the hydrant. And I just remember running back to my company, and I was telling them, "Hey, Engine 10 is here. Let's go. We need to go." Because, you know, back then, DC, Washington, we had a very aggressive department. And so, you know, it wasn't far-fetched to believe that somebody would come in and try to take your fire if you weren't on scene. So, you know, we were aggressively getting ready, heading to the fire, and all I remember is when I got up to the front door, there was heavy, heavy black smoke billowing out of here. Met us at the door, and you know, dropped down to my knee to put on my gear. Lou had already advanced in line inside, and I got my mask on, my helmet on, and I grabbed the hose line to follow him in, and it was moderate heat, you know, enough to let you know that it was you were running into something, but it wasn't anything that was that we hadn't experienced before at that time. But visibility was absolutely none. There was no visibility. You couldn't see your hand in front of your face. That was some very thick, heavy black smoke that was coming out that front door. So that's what we first encountered.
Just to clarify, because obviously some of the terminology down here is a little bit different. Can you just, what is the layout man?
So the layout man is the one who will take the hose line off the back of the fire truck and connect to the fire hydrant.
Okay.
So that's for, you know, city municipalities. I'm not exactly sure how it works in out in the counties where I know a lot of companies in the rural areas will have tankers that will support. So I'm not sure how that all works.
Okay.
But in the city, you know, we have the fire hydrants there, and we'll, my job was to connect the hose line from the back of the fire truck to the hydrant, and then the fire truck, the engine would go on to take his position in front of the working fire, and then he would make connections from that hose to the engine.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah, because I was trying to, I was picking up on it just a little bit, but I wanted to make sure, because terminology down here, I'm sure across the country, it's laid out a little bit differently.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah.
So, so y'all are first on. When reading the report, y'all's nozzleman was having an issue with his face piece. Is that correct?
Yes. From my understanding, when I first got back to the apparatus to put my gear on, he and the wagon driver were running back to the piece, and he had asked me for my face piece because I think Lou's face piece, I don't know if the straps had failed, but something had failed. So he ended up grabbing the wagon driver's face piece and using that as he prepared to enter into the building.
All right, so you guys have now made entry. You're talking about you got an enormous amount of heat, that just thick black smoke pushing. You guys are pushing forward, and then kind of explain what happens from there as you guys are making your initial push.
So the townhouse that we were entering was very small and you know, square footage. I think it was probably about 32 feet from the front door to the rear sliding glass door. So front to back, 32 feet. So we were crawling down the hallway that was leading back to the living room area. And, you know, as I said, first entry, heavy smoke, couldn't see anything in front of you. Got to a certain point back towards the living room and had visibility. Whereas I could see that we were in the living room. I could see the sliding glass door that was in front of us off to the left. I could see the kitchenette. I could see the dinette area. So we had obviously passed by the source of the heat and the smoke. And I asked Lou if he had found the fire at this time. He said he was still looking. And shortly after that, I turned to, you know, visually search the room. So as I was describing, off to the left, the sliding glass door, the dinette, the kitchenette. So I'm making I'm looking towards my left the whole route. And then once I looked over my left shoulder back towards where we had come from, I saw a flash of flame blow through the basement door. Mm-hmm. It was quick. It came in and then it went away. And we lost all visibility. The room blackened down to the point where we couldn't see anything. And the heat was unbelievable. I had never experienced anything like that before. And the heat was on top of us to the point where I lost contact with the hose line, and I believe Lou did as well. And I was scrambling in my gear, trying to get some relief from the heat, moving deeper into the townhouse to get away from it. And it was just something that I had never experienced before. And I, you know, even in the short period of time that I had been on the department, I had been in some pretty hot fires. And this was something that I could have never imagined.
What was the average years of service for your crew?
That's a tough one. Average years.
Were you the youngest guy?
No. Lou was the youngest guy. I think he had 6 years on at the time,
Okay.
6 or 7 years, and I probably had 8 years at the time. I believe the officer, Lou Redding, who was the lieutenant, he may have been a 10-year vet,
Okay.
and then the wagon driver, Donnie Lewis, I know he had been at Engine 26 for about 15 years.
So everybody had, I mean, there was, so yeah, it wasn't a rookie issue at all. So this is a very
No.
well-seasoned crew.
Yes.
Okay. And so y'all had
Yes.
that just enormous heat. And from the time that you guys actually made entry to this point, how much time it actually lapsed? Is it from my report, I mean, from what I watched any of those videos, the whole thing lasted, it was about 2 minutes. Am I correct?
So it was probably about closer to 3 or 4 to 5 minutes from the entry point into the room.
Okay.
But it was about 2 minutes from the point where we got hit with the heated gases to when I exited the building.
Okay.
So it was a it wasn't a long we weren't in there for a very long period of time. And the when the heat hit us, from the time, based on the report that that NIST had developed, and that's the National Institutes of Science and Technology, based on that report, from the entry of the heat to from tolerable temperatures around somewhere around 500 to 600 degrees to the heated temperature that we got burned at 1500 degrees,
Jesus,
was
golly,
about 2 seconds
golly.
from the temperature change. Traveling at approximately, I think they calculated it at 15 miles per hour.
How many seconds did you say?
Two.
Two?
Golly.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
So
So
this.
there was no way to prepare for that.
No, it's it because it's
I don't
counter.
know how you could prepare for anything in 2 seconds.
Well, it's counter to everything that they teach you in the academy, right? Is what well, you know the academy always teaches you, go to the full fog, to fight, which we all is now been debunked. But that doesn't give you time to even think.
No,
That's
no,
my God. So who ended up finding the knowledge? Because y'all were able to get a little bit of cooling to be able to exit the building. You were able to exit the building with the cooling, correct? Or so was it you
yes,
that found the nozzle?
yes.
Okay, and then you put it on a full fog to try to protect yourselves a little bit.
Full fall. I put a straight stream
Straight
to the
stream.
ceiling
My man. My man.
with a circle pattern
Yeah.
to knock it down. So again, the temperature change in that room was significant, and the amount of time that we had to respond to it, obviously 2 seconds, it doesn't give you time to do much. So Lou and I had brief conversation about, something has definitely gone wrong in this situation. We need to get out. And unfortunately, at the time, and some of the changes that came afterward, was that all firefighters didn't carry radios at the time, only the officer.
That was going to be
So
one of my
basically,
questions, yeah.
yeah, so the officer was the only one that carried radios. And basically, Lou Matthews and myself, we were in communication with each other because we were right next to each other and supporting each other. But, beyond that, it wasn't like we could call for a mayday. It wasn't anything.
God, that's terrifying.
That's the way that the departments used to operate back then. And I asked him if he had the hose line. He said he didn't, and I didn't as well. So I said, we need to find it because we need to get out. And so, I had the wherewithal to look around, and as God would have it, I probably reached out about 3 or 4 feet in front of me, and I found a nozzle. And I took it, rolled on my back. I could see the heated gases starting to bang down. It had every sign of flashing over. And I opened up the straight stream to the ceiling, did a circle pattern to try to cool it down. And believe it or not, and all of that, you could feel the temperature drop. And so I did a second pattern on the circle pattern on the ceiling, rolled over again and followed the hose line out, not knowing at the time if Lou Matthews had already gotten out or not. But once I came outside, I just basically dove out the front door, rolled on my back, and I told them where they could find Lou. And then from that point, they would try to cool me down. They said some of the stories that I've heard from the guys since then. They said that my gear was smoking. They couldn't, it was hot to the touch. They couldn't even touch it. And so they used hose lines to try to cool me down. And then, of course, wanted to cut my gear off of me. And so, yeah, that was it all happened really fast. Again, 2 minutes from the time that we got hit with the heat to the time that I made it out the room, t 2 seconds from the time when the heat temperature changed to the extremes. And then when they cut my gear off, it's like they pulled my gloves off and the skin from my fingers were hanging. They cut my t-shirt off and the skin from my stomach went with it. And the whole time I was thinking, this is really not good.
Oh,
I didn't know how
jeez.
badly I was burned, but
Yeah.
I knew this wasn't it was the worst burn that I had had at that point.
And from what I've read and and seen, you were awake through the entire duration until you got to the hospital and they realized that you needed to go under because it was a lot worse, I guess, than they had anticipated. Am I correct?
Yes, that's correct. I recall conversations that I had with the medics in the back of the unit, and I recall a conversation I had with the nurse when I was in in the in MedStar, the emergency room. And I don't know exactly when they put me out, but I do remember all those things. I remember as I was laying there, and they brought in the second firefighter that they had recovered from the fire. And so, I have a vivid memory of all of that.
Yeah.
And then after they put me out, of course, the next time I woke up, which I don't, I think I wrote about it in my book. My book hasn't published yet, but I wrote about it in the book where I woke up during the surgery, and I must have made a noise or something because I looked down and I could see the doctors operating on my legs. And then they turned and looked at me.
Oh, wow.
And the next thing you know, I was back out again. So,
Golly, God.
yeah.
So you guys lost one, and then Engine 10 lost one, correct?
Yes.
And so let me kind of back up. All right, so you've now exited the building, right? You're on the front lawn, and what is going through your mind at this moment? Because you just literally 5 minutes ago, you were performing your operations as a layout man, and you were getting ready to make a hard push in, right? And then 5 minutes has gone by, and now you're in the front yard, and in essence, your skin is now melted off you. What is going through your mind? Because obviously that fight or flight kicked in. You knew exactly how to default to your skill set that you were taught. You got on your back, you got that straight stream shot up to the ceiling, and you started controlling that environment the best that you could to give yourself and everybody else a survivable chance to get the hell out of there. But what goes through your mind at that point once that adrenaline dump just stops? What was going on?
So let me back up just a bit, especially for some of the younger firefighters that might be listening to this, and even some of the
Absolutely.
seasoned ones. The reason I was able to get out, one, and I have to profess this to the end of times. One was because God allowed it; He
100%.
gave me an opportunity. But my training kicked in, so my training was locked in to the point that I knew what what to do in that instance. So I'll give you the example that I share with everyone because it was such a real, it was so real that it, I can't do it any other way. During the academy, we had a drill where we would follow a hose line into a maze. Mm-hmm. And then we had to find our way out of the maze. So I can remember this one drill where I had gotten really frustrated. I was not panic mode, but it was a lot of commotion going on because, you know, they had all the firefighters in that same maze.
Yeah.
And my instructor at the time was in my ear. I couldn't see, but he was in my ear. He told me the first thing I needed to do was control my breathing.
Right.
Second thing I needed to do was think and think about what I needed, what was my next move. And then the third thing I needed to do was execute it. So while I was in that environment, when that heat was on top of us and I didn't have a connection to the hose line, and I was panicking, starting to panic because of what we were experiencing, his voice was in my ear and he said, control your breathing, which I did. And I started to slow down my breathing. And he told me to think. And I thought, hey, I need to find this hose line, I need to find a nozzle to cool this place down. And then I need to execute that and follow the hose line out, just like I was trained at the academy 8 years prior to this. So that's what got me out of there. Now, when I got outside, I was, you know, I really didn't have much thought other than the fact that I was hoping that Lou had gotten out. I felt like I knew that I was burned because I could feel the bee stings all over my body, especially on my face.
Yeah.
But I didn't know at that point how badly I was burned. So I thought it was one of those things where I would go to the hospital. They'd put a couple of bandages on me, send me home the next day. I'd get a week off from work, maybe two, and then I would be back to work. That's what I thought at
right.
the time. So that's probably where my mindset was, is, you know, it doesn't look like my wife and I, well, my girlfriend and I are going to go on vacation right now because I got to heal from this. you know, that kind of, those were the things that I was thinking about. And then, you know, I had to apologize to one of our firefighters when I was there. One of our female firefighters who was standing over top of me and cooling me down with the hose line. And, you know, I asked her, I said, did I burn my junk off?
Oh my.
And I'm using the word lightly. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
Did I burn off? She was like, nah, man, nah, you okay. But, you know, that was my concern.
Yeah, I get it, man.
Well, you got a girlfriend, of course.
Well, man, yes, yes.
And so you get to the hospital, and mm-hmm. you're under. When did you begin to realize the severity of the situation and the burns?
Wow, you know, I don't know when the severity kicked in, but I do recall waking up in my room. And at the foot of my bed was, it seemed like 100 people looking back at me. Oh, wow. And so the whole time I'm thinking, you know, I'm still thinking that I'm going to get out of there in another day or two, you know. And I didn't realize at the time that I had tubes down my throat because, you know, they had intubated me. Mm-hmm. I had a feeding tube down my nose. I had IVs and every place that they could stick one. I had the blood pressure cuff on my arm, and I was bandaged from head to toe. And so the whole time I thought I was talking to everybody, but it turns out that they couldn't hear me because, you know, I had this tube in my throat. And so basically I can only gesture to say that, you know, I was okay. Someone mentioned that I did a thumbs up to say everything was okay. I guess after the first week when I was still there and, you know, the nursing staff would have to come and take me to the room. I used to call it the room, but where they would actually have to bathe me. Mm-hmm. And I think that's when the reality started to kick in. It's like, this is serious. And I heard the story that it didn't, they, my family didn't tell me right away, because I kept asking about Lou Matthews. I kept asking, had he made it out? I was asking my sister, had he, have you heard about what's going on with Lou? Have you heard? And she didn't have the strength at the time to tell me that he had passed. I think she was trying to protect me as well. And I didn't know that he had passed away until the Thursday before his funeral. I think he was funeralized on Friday, I believe. And I didn't watch the news until that Thursday. And so, and I didn't know about Tony Phillips. No, maybe it was Tony who was buried on Friday and Lou on Saturday. I can't remember now. But I just saw the news coverage of one of the funerals. It came on, and then I asked them to turn it off because I couldn't watch it. And it just made me realize that I may be next. That's kind of where my mind was. I said, I may be next. And so, yeah.
Man,
I don't know if that answered the question.
no, that did. That did.
No, I'm just sitting here looking at pictures of both of them, Tony and Lou, and just listening to the story. And just it's I don't know. I'm just trying to.
You try to wrap your head around something like that. I told you a little bit about Zach before we got started, and we've had other burn survivors on, and each time, I try to wrap my head around what, being burned and then what you're going to have to go through in the future. Because now, I mean, it's a completely new journey that's gotten started. And
Absolutely.
it's the length and the surgeries and the change of your behavior. And I can't, I can't imagine. I know many of the burn survivors who lost people, the survivor guilt. Talk us through the mental side of this, and how many surgeries were you getting up to, and kind of just kind of walk us through that.
The mental side of it, I guess at the time, well, I won't say I guess. I know at the time when I was going through the initial stages, my only thought was death was not an option. I had, two young kids that I had to get home to. I mentioned that how I started the fire department was raising my son as a single parent, but then I had a young daughter that had come along 10 years later after him. And I just knew that I had to get home to them. So I just at that I guess my fight was doing what I had to do in order to get back home. And then I had a major support group that was unbelievable. My wife, my family, my sisters, my friends, the fire department. I was constantly being encouraged and supported, which helped with a lot of what I was going through on the surface. They couldn't do anything with the internal dealings, but they definitely were able to help me on the surface to stay focused and to, want to get better. It was almost like I couldn't let them down at that point. So many people had been coming to visit and spend time with me. I had some amazing stories of support while I was in the hospital, and then even afterward with the support that I received from family, friends, and the firefighter family as well.
What was your initial percentage for survival? It was fairly low, am I correct?
That they gave me 5% chance of survival, probably for the first month that I was in the hospital.
Jeez.
Well, maybe the 5% was the first 2 weeks, the critical time, and then it was 50% from that point until I got to the stage where I went to the step down unit, which is where you come out of ICU and you go down to the actual burn unit, and it's less of you're less critical at that point. You may be
Right.
in serious condition. So I spent 2.5 months in the hospital. Two of those months were in ICU, actually.
Yeah.
And the transition from there was incredibly difficult psychologically. Because, from that point, everyone was taking care of me. So now I had to get to the place where I had to take care of myself.
Yeah.
And that was hard, a hard transition. You had asked about the surgeries, and I think I skipped over it. So in the time spent at the hospital, that initial, I think I had about 15 surgeries from the time that I first came into Washington Hospital Center until I left to go home. And then over the years, and this is a span of 20 years now, over 20, but I've had in excess of 45 surgeries in
Gosh.
total.
Remind me what the burn percentage was?
So 65% was the
65%.
burn percentage. So basically, the circumference of both of my arms, both of my legs, my back, my lower abdomen, the back of my head, my fingers, and it's interesting that the burn patterns stop at where my boots stopped and where my boxer shorts stopped.
Oh, wow.
But everything else was burned pretty severely.
Mean, it re-emphasizes the importance for especially these young guys wearing your gear right,
Yeah.
making sure your stuff is squared away each morning, taking the time for the rig checks to make sure every bit of piece of equipment that the department offers you is set and ready to go. And you've got to take care of that. That's, man, I'm just. It's so hard to sit there and listen. I mean, 45 surgeries now, 20 years later, you said roughly in that time frame. I can't
Yes.
fathom the pain because burn care is not what it was back then,
No.
especially what we're trying to do now.
Yeah.
You know, and this was the old antiquated ways of doing stuff. As we've always said, Vietnam era tactics is burn care.
Yeah.
It didn't have the research like we have now and the data that we have now. And my, granted, it's not any better.
Yeah.
I mean,
There's
there's not a pain-free way of
the amount of
handling
approve
this.
the progress that we need to make is it's massive.
Yeah, it's insane. But to know that, hear stories like this, it puts the mission into perspective,
Yep.
but what we're trying to push forward here. And I just, hearing your story, man, it brings it back, and to hear it from your words, from the words from your mouth especially, brings the realism to the event itself. I mean, we could read about the reports, read the NIOSH reports, the DC fire reports, and I could see the videos, but it doesn't seem as real until I talk to you and hear your stories direct, and then looking at Lou Matthews' photos and Anthony Phillips's photos, just sitting here listening to you talk about them, and just imagining that you're riding next to him,
Yeah.
and you got in there, you made a hallway push with them, and in a matter of five minutes,
Yep.
the world's changed.
Yes.
With this fire, did anything come out of it? What were the lessons learned by the departments? Greg mentioned some studies were done, or do you know much about on that side?
Yes, quite a few things came out of this. So I want to circle back to wearing your gear properly, which is key to this story. Because in the past, firefighters will often shortcut putting the gear in. Nomex hoods. Some of the older cats would say, if you wear the hood, you can't feel when things are getting bad, so you shouldn't wear the hood, or they chose not to. The gear, because it's so the because of the technology is so good, it really protects you, but it also hurts you. And because by the time things get severe, like what they did at Cherry Road, it's almost too late to make a recovery. But my gear at the time was probably about 3 years old. We used to get a new set of gear maybe every 3 years at that time, and it was only one set, right? So it probably was at its half life, if that makes any sense. I think gear is rated somewhere around 1200 degrees, brand new out the pack. And so it was probably at half life, and then we're talking about 1500 degree turnaround. So that was a compromised situation in itself. And then we didn't have the understanding of cleaning our gear the way that they do now. And so that added to the degradation of the materials, I'm sure. So some of the things that came out of this was, one, all firefighters having radios, which is a major change, and it gives every firefighter a fighting chance, right? At the time, the chief, the responding chief, drove himself to the fire ground and had to monitor the radio and listen to fire ground size up from first due, second due companies, all of this while he's responding. So since then, they provided the chief with an aide driver, so
Good.
he can focus on fire ground operations while he's being driven to the scene. At the time, there were budget cuts in the truck companies. We used to have a six-man truck company. It had dropped down to four men,
Y'all had six-man
and
trucks?
we had six-man trucks, back then.
Oh,
Well,
man.
so they dropped it down, and we were running a four-man truck that night. And so I think they're back up to a five-man truck company.
Jeez.
Let's see, they implemented the safety officer on the fire ground, where one officer is his sole job is to make sure that the fire ground operation is op that the guys are operating safely and doing what they're supposed to do. We implemented some of the firefighter rescue training, like the save your own training, where ladder bailout. I can't remember some of the other drills. Denver drill, I think one of them was called, but it was basically helping firefighters to do self-rescue or team rescue of downed firefighters, which that was an implementation afterwards. And so those were some of the things that changed as immediate, well, within a few years of the incident, which.
That sounds massive. Those changes, like when you mentioned that individuals didn't have radios, like just from somebody who's not in the fire service, I'm going, that just sounds like a no brainer to me. Like you're inside of a burning building. I feel like you would need some communication out there. And then you jump into the fire chief having to, it's those sound like changes that have legitimately saved many, many lives now.
Yes. I truly believe that. And one of the other things I failed to mention. So the integrated pass alerts, which is that alarm that sounds when a firefighter is down, that I think he will be at rest for about 30 seconds, and then it would a sound to alert other firefighters where he would be if, in case he's in a untenable, blackened down environment. At least firefighters could follow that beacon to get to him. So they were just implementing the integrated fire, the integrated passes.
Oh, sorry. One second.
No, that's okay. No, that's fine. I understand.
So, integrated passes.
So they had just started experimenting with the integrated pass alerts, which were a part of the air pack. The one that I had, or myself and Lou Matthews had, was a manual pass alert. So you had to actually turn it on manually for it to activate. Mm-hmm. Whereas the integrated pass alert, you just turn on your air bottle and it's activated. So Engine 10 was one of the companies that they had elected to try these new integrated pass alerts with. So Tony Phillips had an integrated pass alert. Myself and Lou Matthews had the manual, and I didn't turn mine on. I could tell you that for a fact. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking that Lou probably didn't turn his on, because when the first search team went in to look for Lou Matthews, because they at that time they only understood one firefighter to be down, they went to the pass alert that they heard. Mm-hmm. And when they pulled the down firefighter that they found, it turned out to be Tony Phillips.
Oh.
And so that's when they had to go back and do a second search to find Lou Matthews. So I did mention that from the time that we got hit with that heated gas and my exit of the building was approximately 2 minutes, mm-hmm. Lou Matthews was in that environment for 20 minutes.
Oh, shoot.
Gosh. Oh, my gosh. That is...
I can't imagine. No. He was burned... third degree burn over 90% of his body.
Mm-mm-mm. It's, you know, when we talk about these scenarios so often, Bemis and I are pretty much left speechless by the severity of the topic, and this is no different. But we do, you know, we're coming to the end of our show, and we do want to try to end on something that, you know, the fact that there has been changes, and, you know, the Lord works in mysterious ways is an understatement, but the fact that these changes have come around and the number of lives that they must have saved due to this extremely tragic event is just so happy that people have learned, that there was a lesson learned from this. It's always terrible when we have to lose people to learn these lessons. But the fact that we didn't do the human thing and just overlook it, we actually took it on ourselves to come out of the other end and say, we got to figure out how to make this not happen again, or hell, at least lower the damn percentage and chance of it happening again.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
And so did you go back to work afterwards?
I did. I was able to get back to work. It was approximately a year and a half, almost exact. And I was working with the down the training academy, training firefighters. And so, you know, I didn't want to go to the training academy. I really wanted to be able to go back to firefighting. That's what I was actually fighting to do.
Yeah.
But I ended up down the training academy, and it became a rewarding position that, you know, I didn't expect that I would fall in love with as well. But I did that, and I was there for about 4 years before I was forced into retirement.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can guarantee you that the people you taught, to hear that firsthand experience from you, the value of that, I can guarantee you, is cannot be understated.
No.
It's funny. I laugh about it now, but I have had the opportunity to go back, and I still go back when invited to go down and talk to some of the recruit classes, and just to give them some insight of what to expect, and to give them the wherewithal to be cognizant of doing this job to the best of their ability, and not taking it for granted.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes, they will be the officers, like the captains, the chiefs of the different houses. And they will come to me and say, yeah, you came down and spoke to my recruit class. Hmm. And I'm like, holy moly, am I that old? Are you kidding me? But it's really cool to see. And, people just will randomly say that it had an impact on their career. And that is what's been so important. Now, I did want to say something, and I want to share this because it's often overlooked and it's very important, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So, we've had the loss of the two firefighters that were with me, Tony Phillips and Lou Matthews, which was a tragic, tragic loss for the department and their families. And it brought about some definite needed changes. But that same year, we lost a third firefighter. And his loss of life was just as traumatic because he served the department for 32 years. And his name was Costello Robinson. And Costello was a wagon driver for one of the firehouses, one of the companies in BC, Engine Company Number 2. And while I was in the hospital, he was on a call and got attacked by a pit bull.
Mm.
And so he was in the hospital for surgery, and he died from a heart attack while in surgery.
Oh, man.
Yes. And I used to call him the Colonel. And he was a wealth of knowledge, such a nice guy. But in the notoriety of the incident at Cherry Road, a lot of times his passing is kind of overlooked. But DC, that was a traumatic year for Washington, D.C. Fire Department in 1999 because they lost three firefighters that year.
Golly.
So I wanted to mention that because I haven't, even in my past times, opportunities to speak about Cherry Road, I've often missed the opportunity to share Costello Robinson.
Thank you for sharing that.
Absolutely. Thank you for sharing that. Well, Joe, it has been a blessing to talk to you and to hear your story. And knowing Bemis and I, we could sit here with you for another hour if they'd give it to us. I can't wait to connect you with Zach and DJ and work more with you, and not only spread your story, but spread your sense of optimism that these things, when they happen, you have to fight.
Mm-hmm.
You have to find a way and keep that faith, and with that, all things are possible.
All things are possible.
I've wrote down the three words that you said earlier: control, think, and execute. I've got them written here, I've been reading those three words over and over and over again.
I think that's going to be the title of this podcast.
I think so too.
Wow.
I'm telling you, they're right here on my computer screen right now. quoted by Joe Morgan: control, think, and execute. It's that means a lot, and just to hear your story, man, I from the bottom of my heart, I thank you for even taking the time to speak with us. But thank you for honoring the spirit and your fallen brothers, all three of them,
yeah,
from DC Fire in 99. Obviously Lou and Tony from this fire, but also you said Costello Robinson, the Colonel.
Yes.
Thank you for sharing their memory. because I'm real big, and I know Landon and this organization is real big about never forgetting.
Absolutely.
And we stand by that. And
that's why we have the moment of silence.
Yep.
We want to see as few names up there, and if there's a name that we need to share, we need to share it.
Yes, absolutely. And I applaud you and celebrate you for what you're doing, because it's so important. And you're reaching people that may not otherwise be reached, and you're going to make a difference in their lives. And I want to tell you guys that I stand and salute you.
I appreciate it.
God bless you.
God bless you
too, man. Thank you so much, Joe. We hope you have a phenomenal, phenomenal day, phenomenal month, and a phenomenal year, and going on a phenomenal life.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
And if you're ever in Texas, you better look us up, brother.
Yeah, you got to stop by the office.
Guaranteed.
You tell Greg. Right. You tell Greg that he owes you a trip up here. So.
All right, I'll do that.
All right, brother, be good, man. Thank you.
All right,
you.
Bro. You see too. You thank you. Bye. See ya.
Golly.
Yeah.
Another one. Another one. Yeah. Just what an incredible person.
It's an amazing individual. But the emotions, like, I feel I'm drained. I'm reading. He's talking, and I'm reading the NIOSH report as he's talking, and in my mind, I'm listening to him, and I'm just living out this horror of a story, and reading the report as I'm going along with him, I'm just sitting here, I'm like, what in the hell, man? Thank God he's alive, because thank God we have his story.
Yeah.
And thank God we can honor Tony and Lou.
Yeah.
On that day, because there are a lot of lessons learned. And if there's anything that we can learn in the fire service, is that things can change in a matter of seconds.
Yeah. 2 seconds. There was a part of my brain that wanted to convince me that he said 10.
That's what I thought he said too.
I wanted to convince myself, but I knew I heard 2. And to be going from 500 degrees to 1500 degrees in 2 seconds, literally nothing you can do.
I mean, reading
the fact that and his instincts kicked in,
he even said it, you know, went back to the basics of his training, what he was told, right?
Yep.
Control your breathing, think, then execute. He rolled onto his back, controlled the environment, you know, and if you read the reports about the 2 victims, it's even worse, and I'm glad we didn't get into it.
Yeah.
But I encourage you guys, especially new dudes,
20 minutes in there,
go read these reports. They're there for a reason. You know,
what's the report?
The NIOSH reports.
NIOSH reports.
You know, these reports that come out after these line of duty deaths, you've got to read these things. We have got to read these things. You know, we're never going to continue to learn from our mistakes if we don't read these things. And thank God, DC Fire recognized there was 11 recommendations, if I remember correctly, 11 recommendations made by DC Fire, and it looks like they made every damn recommendation.
That's
they
phenomenal.
Fixed it.
He was going through the list of things that did change. I mean, I was shocked that the radio deal, that still just blows my mind.
Yeah.
But going through that list, and you hate to have to say it. It's like, you don't want to – I hate thinking these things happen for reasons or something along those lines. But
right.
There can be a reason. You can make a reason out of these things.
Yeah.
Things – I don't know if they happen for a reason or not, but unless you're willing to make that reason, then they're not going to. And the fact that they were able to look at this and they were willing to admit fault and they were willing to take the steps to make some changes, that's honoring the people who passed.
Yeah.
That's honoring their memory by saying, we don't want this to happen again on our watch. The fact that they didn't know where I can't remember which one, where he was in the fire, Lou.
Yeah.
But the fact they didn't know where Lou was.
Yeah. 20 minutes.
20 minutes.
Yeah.
And they found
Tony.
Tony. And it's just that shouldn't happen.
No.
That should never happen.
You know, and it's, you know, I just, the whole story itself is, it's just mind boggling. And, you know, I'm so blessed to be a part of this organization, to hear these stories. And it's unfortunate that we have to hear these stories, but it's like you said, this is a divine thing. This is a God thing.
Yep.
God's put us in these positions to listen to these stories. God put him in the position that he's in And even though he had to endure so much pain, there's a reason he's there.
Yeah.
He lost two brothers that day, but there's a reason. He's because he's carrying a legacy on. He's carrying their memory on.
With invaluable knowledge.
Invaluable knowledge. And the fact that he went to the training division is genius because it's basically said, now let me tell you.
Yeah. Yep.
This is real life right here. You're looking at me.
Yeah, you're looking at real life.
This is real life. This is what happens.
This isn't a PowerPoint. Yep. This isn't some sort of video presentation with hypotheticals. Yep. This is it.
This is real life. I can take you to the exact place that's still there. And there's a video out there. If you guys get a chance, go watch it. It's through the FSRI. They did a video in the ISFSI. They put a video together on this with Joe.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of talking about that day, and it's about 30 minutes in length, but it is phenomenal. So,
well, I feel like we got another good one in the bag, and
yep.
as intense as that was, I feel so honored and blessed to be able to share it.
100%.
I mean, it's just to be able to share some of these stories that these incredible people go through.
Yeah.
The stark difference between our last one and this one. You know, kind of healing with humor, and then I feel like this is learning the lesson. And what are those three things?
Control, think, execute.
Control, think, execute.
That's how we end the show, is those three words. But I just want to also make sure, sonsoftheflag.org, social media is all at sonsoftheflag.
Yep.
Look us all up there. If you need anything, you know, if you're burned or if you need a burn assistance, contact us on the website, sonsoftheflag.org.
Yep.
Sherry or Landon will get back with you. If you want to join the task force, there's Greg.
Yep.
Greg is DC retired, legend.
Yep.
And
thank you, Greg, for
And then we have
everything.
Zach and DJ now carrying on the mission,
yep.
Doing their thing. And so
hopefully Joe, too. I can't wait to get them together.
No, we're in a beautiful spot, man. And to know that this story is going out on its anniversary.
Oh, that's huge.
24 years.
You
99.
Were listening to this on,
yep.
on the anniversary. And yeah. I hope you grasp the significance of that.
Absolutely. So thank you from the bottom of my heart. It's been an absolute pleasure, everybody. Landon, it's always a pleasure.
Always
brother.
Good sitting down with you,
yes.
brother.
And I'm going to end it with his words, right? Control, think, execute.
Rock and roll.
Thank you.